Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And this week we are going to, me and Jem, we're a couple of fashionable guys. You know, we're always down with the fashions. We're wearing the latest threads. I'm currently sitting here in my Gucci shoes and my Louis Vuitton handbag, and you can tell I know absolutely nothing about this.
Okay. No, those are things. Those are things. I'm currently Jean-Paul Gaultier. I love his lines. I think that his colours are spectacular. So yes, I'm all about Jean-Paul Gaultier today.
Now I'm going to have to hurry you along, Jim, because obviously I do have to get back to the runway and carry on modelling my clothes this afternoon, but. Yes. Even if we are not the most au fait of people with modern clothing, Jim, we are going to ignore fashion and we're going to look a little bit at historical clothing today.
Yeah, because pretty much all cultures and civilizations have come up with the idea of you've got to kind of cover yourself up. Sometimes it's necessity, you know, because of fairly harsh environments, you'd get something like Eskimos or Inuits having to kill seals and using the thick skins of these animals to allow them to survive in such harsh and brutal winters. Then you've got probably one of the most famous ones, the ancient Egyptians, where in essence they're basically walking around in skirts. But let's face it, Egypt's hot. That seems fairly sensible. I find it interesting that different civilizations have come up with different solutions, and actually we can track certain trends even from different areas. So it's a light-hearted one, as it were. So any opening thoughts from you?
My immediate opening thought when we start looking at the history of clothes is, as you say, there are sort of two levels to clothes. There is clothing out of necessity, and then there is clothing out of fashion. And I think it's really interesting when you look through history to see how both of those have changed, partly in context. But you think that throughout history, the poorest of people would always look the same, because you kind of think to yourself, well, there's got to be a very, very basic, necessary level of clothes for any particular country. If they're the basic, they're the cheapest, they're the easiest to make, surely that would say. And yet, even fashion among sort of the poorest elements changes. You know, I always expect it at the top end, where they're constantly reinventing, they're pushing forward, they've got the money to, you know, splash out on lavish clothing. But to me, it's always interesting that at the lowest end, also, that clothing changes and does stick to a fashion and a style. And the reasons behind that are sometimes less obvious than you might think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to start with one area which you think, oh my goodness, can you actually make this interesting? But I assure you I'm going to give it a shot. Let's go to the Romans, which, you know, we've done on a number of occasions. And we all know that the Romans were heavily influenced by Greek civilization. If you look at some of their philosophy, if you look at their architecture, legal system, their gods even, although they changed their names. So, yes, clearly one society is heavily influenced and linked to the other. But there's one key area, and it's really interesting. If you look at some of the Greek pots, you'll look at the soldiers, the Greek hoplites, as they're called, these heavily armoured Greek soldiers with their bronze shields and bronzed helmets and chest plates and the greaves and arm guards and all this stuff. And you think, wow, you know, that must be so hard to get through. And then you look at their feet and you realise, hang on, they're marching into battle barefoot. And actually, in the ancient world, a lot of civilizations didn't bother with shoes, okay? And the weird thing is that shoes were a key part of Roman civilization. So type of sandal tended to have been worn indoors. And basically, if you were a Roman citizen, you would have shoes. It was a sign of status. Now, clearly, if you were a pleb, i.e. a kind of working class Roman citizen, your shoes would be functional. If you were a rich aristocrat, you would have dangly things off them, etc. Now, perhaps the most famous Roman shoe is the caliga, the Roman soldiers, the Roman legion's shoe, boot, except you probably think it's a sandal because it's open at the top, but that was for a reason. If you're marching for miles, the heat coming off your foot, it finds it hard to come out of leather, but it's, you know, if the top of it's open, then that's absolutely fine. But from the sides down, it was very much a boot. And indeed, most people don't realize them. They were hobnailed. So they had metal studs in the bottom of them to give them grip as they walked along. But also, imagine fighting a whole bunch of enemies where they're not wearing shoes. You know, suddenly your foot, your caliger becomes a new weapon. You stamp on someone's foot, they're going to pause, okay? That will hurt a lot. And while they're wincing in pain, or perhaps reaction to try and clutch their foot, you can shove a sword in their guts, and that's how you can win a battle, okay? And if you're thinking Caligar, hang on, Caligula, is that the same? Yeah, Caligula was actually his nickname. Caligula means little boots, because he went on a campaign in Germany, and he was dressed up in a full Roman officer's outfit, and was given, you know, he was a little boy, and he was given little boots. Everyone called him Caligula. And then what's interesting is that when slaves were freed, everybody knows that when gladiators were freed, they were given a wooden sword, a wooden gladius, okay? But if you were just a house slave or something like that, that would mean nothing. But quite often, when you were freed, you were given a pair of shoes. In other words, you're part of society. And similarly, when, not always, but sometimes in Roman weddings, as a symbol of you know, the passing of power, the father-in-law would give shoes to the groom to say, you know, I used to be, I'm sorry, I know this is a patriarchal society and everything, I'm sorry, everybody, but it's saying, you know, I used to be in charge of this woman, but now as your husband, as you're the husband, you get to be in charge of this woman. I'm not saying that's right, but it's interesting that a pair of shoes was shown to symbolize that. And indeed, in Tutankhamun's burial finds, there's a picture of him getting married. And what's interesting is the bride and groom share a pair of shoes. In other words, we're kind of unified as one. I'm wearing one shoe on my right hand foot and you're wearing the other shoe on your left foot. So, as something as dull as shoes actually has important implications in the world of history and understanding certain cultures and what a pair of shoes means.
Yes, and it's wonderful when sort of clothing crosses over from that point of this is clothing that you wear because you need it, and it becomes this symbolic thing, this idea that it becomes a symbol as well. And there are so many items of clothing now, and I'm sure this is one that you were going to touch on as well, so many items of clothing we wear now that really serve no function whatsoever. They don't serve a function, or they're not used in the function that they were originally intended for. One example that springs to mind is a baseball cap, which of course was designed to protect your eyes from the sun. If you're a baseball player, you need to have that over your eyes. These days it's worn as a fashion accessory, and very often, I say very often, I'm not down with the kids, but very often worn backwards. And this just seems, you know, it's strange to those people who look at it and go, well, no, hold on, that peak is there for a reason. It's supposed to keep the sun off of your face if you're wearing it backwards.
I will challenge that. I know exactly what you mean. And yes, by and large, people are wearing them the wrong way. However, on my archaeology digs, sometimes I wore a baseball cap backwards because I had my face down in a trench. I had the sun directly above me, and it protected my neck.
Now, what you're doing, I can understand that version of it. I don't have that problem, I'll be honest with you, Jem. I've got these luscious locks that cover up my neck and keep me safe from keep me safe from sunburn. But I can understand what you're saying there. But again, that's still using the peak for its intended purpose. I'm talking about using it as in a fashion way, where they wear it sideways or backwards, and it's clearly not to keep the sun off the neck or anything else. It's because that's the way they've chosen to wear. And that's wonderful. I'm not being down on that. I like that as a fashion thing. I like the idea of taking something that has a perfectly good use, and then just using it completely differently. But I do like the fact that sometimes we lose the initial purpose of something. And one of the biggest ones of these is, of course, the tie.
Which you... I knew you were going to go there. It's a great story. I put it in my forgotten histories. Yes, off you go.
And, well, actually, I'm going to ask you to tell that story because I've got a vague feeling it was from forgotten histories that I learned it. So I'd like to learn it rather than me taking a story, repeating it, getting it slightly wrong. But what I love now is that these days it's worn as a sign of smartness. You know, people wear the tie. And you're going to set us up with a history of where this actually comes from. And it's the fact that these days, more and more often, you read of it being used psychologically as a leash around the neck of the, you know, and it was used in that way as sort of, oh, no, you, if you're wearing a tie, you're being constrained. And it's as opposed to some people just like looking smart and wearing a tie. You know, personally, I don't. But so, yeah, Jem, take us to the history of the tie.
Well, it gets, I think, unnecessarily complicated in the 20th century. So I'll give you the origins and then sort of like speed you up to the 1990s. So bizarrely, when you're wearing a tie, you're making a nod to Croatian mercenaries, of course, because in this crops up a surprising amount of time. So I guess you have to say that our podcast's favourite obscure war is the 30 Years' War. So this was in the early 1600s. Basically, it started off Protestant versus Catholic, but it all just got horribly messy. And it was an incredibly destructive war. And France hired a bunch of Croatian mercenaries. Now, those Croatian mercenaries, the way their shirts were done up, they basically had a piece of cloth at the top of it to kind of keep the shirt together. It had a functional use, but it was a different colour to the rest of the shirt. And so that was the origin of the tie. However, Louis XIII, who was the king at the time, loved that look so much that he started encouraging people wearing them at court. And he named them after the Croatians. He called it la cravate, which to this day is actually the French name for a tie. However, what we know what a cravat means in Britain is it's kind of a puffier, almost sort of semi-scarf-like type tie. It's not a modern-day tie. So clearly, over the years, it evolved. It basically became less fancy as we didn't need huge frilly collars and things like that. So as fashion calmed down, mass production of clothing increased, so too the tie also calmed down. But what I remember... I'm kind of the last generation who did this, but in the up until the late 1990s, if you were working in an office, you wore a tie. There was no option about it, okay? That's what you wore. But the first dot-com bubble, which burst sort of around about the year 2000, suddenly meant that everybody had to be cool. And, there were all these companies that popped up and evaporated immediately. You know, a few of them survived. But, you know, the things like Amazons and YouTubes of this world came after the initial dot-com bubble. Everybody's having bean bags and lava lamps and chill out rooms and sort of having meetings around pool tables. And it was stupid. It was really, really stupid. At the time, I was sitting there going, has the world gone mad? I know that this is inefficient. And indeed, it turned out to be inefficient. However, there were a few hangovers from that. And one of them was, nobody wears a tie anymore. You know, we should all be walking around in jeans and t-shirt. And indeed, that was the sort of standard uniform, if you like, if you're working for an IT company to this day. But the knock-on effect to just normal offices is ties very much became optional. So you'd wear a suit, you'd wear a shirt, but you'd have that top button undone and you wouldn't have to have your neck throttled by a tie anymore. And so that's a recent piece of history that I've actually evolved through. But, you know, I remember my first year of being in office, in business, to have said to somebody in the office, I'm going to take my tie off now. I might as well have said, I'm going to take my trousers off. You know, it would have been unthinkable. Whereas, well, just yesterday, I was in an office with some people and I was being very professional and I was wearing a suit, but I was not wearing a tie.
Scandalous, Jim. That is scandalous. I mean,
I was wearing trousers for the record.
I mean, I'm a man who doesn't very often wear a tie, I'll be honest with you. I think I've worn ties maybe two or three times in the last year at a couple of weddings. And if I'm a man...
Will you be wearing a tie at your wedding?
No, I will not be wearing a tie at my wedding. What I want to avoid is what I look like when I wear a suit and tie, which, and I'll see if, I'll see if when this goes out, I can find a photograph from my friend's wedding that I can pop up. I tend to look like a, like somebody has just captured a chimpanzee and stuck him in a suit. That's kind of, that's kind of look you get if I wear a shirt and tie. But, taking the tie out of it and just sticking with the idea of the shirt. And anyone that's seen me at my shows, or I'll be honest, wandering around most of the time, knows that I'm most comfortable in my show shirts, which are based on sort of medieval shirts. They're quite flouncy. I've modified them. They're not reenactors' medieval shirts. Let's be clear about that. They are designed. I make my own shirts, and I make them specifically for my shows. I make them in such a way that. Yeah, they're designed for my shows. They're made of a slightly lighter material. They're made of a material that's much dries out. But the interesting thing about that shirt is, if I stick one of my shirts on, you know, it's got some nice flouncy sleeves. I do like a bit of flounce to my sleeve. But when I when I have that shirt on, and I go out, if I just stick on that shirt, pair of trousers like I often do in the shows, if I don't grab one of my show waistcoats or doublets or anything. Maybe stick on a jacket. I go out and about. Nobody seems to bat an eyelid. Nobody questions that particular look. All right, maybe it's a slightly eccentric shirt, but it fits. And it's one of those things I did when I was first working on my shows. And I went through various iterations of costumes before I settled largely on the shirt I wear now. And what is interesting about this one is when I wear my flouncy shirt, a pair of black trousers and a pair of boots, if I stick on one of my steampunk waistcoats, that is pretty much good for any show that I do. I can get away with that. But I kind of look steampunky. I look a bit Victorian, but I can also carry that through. I wear that if I'm, you know, at a war show or anything else, anything post that. If I stick on a doublet, then I can pretty much get away with people assuming that, and this is not historically accurate, but people assuming that I fit in anywhere through the age of knighthood, right through Shakespeare, really, right up until Victorian times. If I take the doublet off and I just wear the shirt, then I can go along and people think I fit in rather well in Saxon times. And it's not an accurate thing. You know, the shirt is definitely not accurate to any of these times. I always refer to it as I tried to find a shirt style that would look slightly odd anywhere I went, but wouldn't look far enough out of place that if I suddenly dropped back in time 1,000 years, people would suddenly start going, it's crazy clothes, he's wearing a T-shirt. And I think it's really, really interesting that I can do that, that I can have an item of clothing that, if you watch TV, if you watch films and that, actually, although the fashion changes a great deal, at the same time, something like a shirt, the styles have changed subtly. And for somebody who really knows their stuff, can tell a suit or a shirt that was made today from probably the turn of the century, going back into sort of the 80s, 70s, 60s, decade by decade, how the shirt and the fashions have changed. And yet, overall, that hasn't changed an awful lot. And yet, when it comes to women's clothing, straight away you get into this thing where it's very hard to find an item of women's clothing that you could have worn over that period of time and not look out of place for all that time.
Yeah, that's very true. It does seem strange that... Now, I'm going to go to the world of hair for a moment, if you will allow me.
Well,
so,
enjoy your visit to the world of hair, Jim. That's
But starting very seriously, I spoke to an aid worker once, and they told me something that's just always stuck in my head. I was probably told this 10 years ago. So if you go to a crisis situation, there's a massive famine or something like that, when do you know when people are starting to recover, okay? Because it's not instantly apparent when people's nourishment levels are going up. You can obviously get nourishment into them and clean water and so on and so forth. But what was interesting is this, what this woman was telling me is the very first sign that recovery, that normality is starting to return to these people, is when women start doing something with their hair. they start kind of worrying about their hair. And actually, it is, I find it fascinating how much how different a woman can look with a different haircut, a different colouring, etc. It can really change the look of a woman. Just something as basic as the strands of cells that hang off the top of your head. They're not part of you, but actually in some ways they are very much define you. So I found that interesting, and linked to that are wigs. So Queen Elizabeth I famously had wigs, and obviously some men, such as myself, are follically challenged. But particularly in the Middle Ages and then going on from that, the amount of people who had lice infestations. So it was simply easier to just shave your head. Okay, no lice if there's no hair, but I still want to look like I have a luscious head of hair, and so wigs were used. Wigs were around in the Roman era. You may at some point, and I put this on my Facebook page recently, with a sarcastic comment underneath it, but some Roman wigs are pretty spectacular and utterly ridiculous. And linked to that, Julius Caesar is thought to have invented the comb over. And also that wearing those sort of laurels in your hair. He also invented that because he had the same problem I did, okay? So it's nice to know I've got something in common with Julius Caesar. The only thing, probably. But in Roman civilization, again, both men and women did wear wigs. Queen Elizabeth I wore a wig. But it's kind of when you get to the time of the Restoration, the sort of the Charles II's, you know. When I was a kid, I thought, wow, he's got such luscious hair. Well, that, of course, is a wig. You could have horsehair wigs, but the absolute finest ones were human hair wigs. And yes, some women would earn a living just growing their hair long and then having it shaved and then it selling it to a wig maker. Now, what's interesting is if you look at like the 1700s, even kind of the time of, and we did this recently, the American Revolution, there are a lot of people wearing grey, white powdered wigs. And then when you look at the Napoleonic Wars, which isn't really even a generation later, I mean, barely, where have all those wigs gone? And the answer is it became out of fashion. You're talking about sort of like fashionableness, but those tricorn hats, those three-sided pointy hats that we associate with pirates, very popular in the early 1700s, and sort of up through to perhaps just around about the time of the War of Independence. But again, by the time you get to the Napoleonic Wars, they're gone. Nobody wears them anymore. They were seen as old-fashioned. It's what my dad used to wear, and therefore I'm not going to wear it. And it was partly the same thing with wigs. In France, wigs were obviously associated with aristocracy, so we can't possibly wear those in revolutionary France. But in Britain, what had happened was there was a hugely expensive wig tax. And so suddenly it became really expensive to wear a wig, so we stopped wearing wigs because we're a bit cheap. And the last thing I'm going to say about this era, that during the period of revolutionary France, they were clearly worried about what women were wearing because they banned women wearing trousers. Women had to wear skirts or dresses. And interestingly, nobody took that off the statutes book in France until past the year 2000. I mean, it was in the last decade where up until then, technically, any woman in France wearing trousers was breaking the law.
And what you've actually done without realizing it, Jem, is you've given me the perfect segue to my plug. So I will let you drop back after this to come back in and give us
a little bit
of history. But I just want to drop one quick plug in because I've not spoken to you about this, I don't think, at all. So
you're about to launch a fashion range? Is that the ulterior motive behind this, Greg?
No, Jem, actually. I wasn't going to mention this at all in this podcast, but I'm going to get my hair cut, Jem, actually. Come to mention.
Okay, is this a plug? Okay, keep going.
This is a plug because I don't know if you've heard of a little thing called Little Princess Trust, Jim.
Oh, yes. Oh, that's lovely. Please tell. Yeah.
So what these guys do is they take people who've got long hair, and you see a lot of people who do a lot of charity things where they shave their heads and things like that for charity. And the Little Princess Trust, their basic thing is you don't have to go as far as shaving your head to help somebody out. And actually, if you have as little as 7 inches cut off of your hair, that can actually then be used to make a wig or go towards making a wig for a child who's had cancer and lost their hair. And this is something that my other half, Felicity, has done before. And we're both kind of let our hair grow out for the last year or so. She'd wanted to do it. I've agreed to go along and do that as well. And we've said sort of coming up to Christmas, we'll have time after that. Our whole point is to say, look, you can have this haircut and it doesn't change anything. If you've got long enough hair, you can have 7 inches off. Vic will probably have a full 12 inches probably taken off of hers. And you can have that cut, and then we've got our wedding in June. Our hair will be back to normal by then. In that way, what difference does it make to us that bit of hair off our heads, and yet to a child who's suffering and who's lost their hair and is doesn't want the extra attention of not having hair, that week could make all the difference. So actually, on the I think off the top of my head, it's the 2nd or 3rd of December, the first Sunday in December. I'm actually going to be on stage at the Isle of Wight Steam Railway, and actually live on stage, somebody is going to be allowed to cut at least 7 or 8 inches off the back of my hair, basically as much as possible, while still maintaining. We want to use this to show to people you don't have to go as extreme as shaving your head. What I'm going to say to the podcast listeners, though, when I'm recording this, I don't have it set up, so I can't give you a web address. But around the time this episode comes out, if you go to my Facebook page, you will find a link to a GoFundMe campaign. Now, I realise I've crowdfunded a lot of things, and I have my Patreon and everything. This is different. My GoFundMe page, none of that money goes to me. That will be money that goes directly to Little Princess Trust, because it costs them money to make the wigs as well. So if you listen to this and you think, oh, how can I help out if Greg's having a haircut? Head over to facebook.com/condensedhistories. Follow that link and see if you've got a little bit of change you can spare coming up to Christmas to help make wigs for children that need them. That was quite a serious little plug to shove in the middle of the show, but you'd built up to it so nicely with the wigs that I couldn't leave it aside, Jim.
Okay. I'm going to be a bit cheeky now and say, so clearly that's a sign that you don't need to do reshoots for The Last Airship, because otherwise that would look weird as suddenly the hero's hair changes length halfway through.
Well, the second series, there will be, the first scene of the second series, if we shoot that anytime soon, no doubt there'll be the moment where we walk in and say, gosh, Lupo, you've done well. I mean, because I've got to fit in my wedding suit as well. Your hair appears to be shorter and you appear to have lost several stones. So, yeah.
Yeah. So Last Airship 2, Greg gets a haircut. That's maybe not the best plot point. Okay, well, I'll do one more bit of history, and I guess we're sort of heading towards the end of this, aren't we?
We are indeed.
So I don't think there's really time for a what if. So just quickly, I always like this one. You did a hat, so I'm going to do a hat as well. The fez. If there's one thing people know about the Middle East, is they wore fezes. Yes, you know exactly what I mean about what a fez is, yep. Right? Yeah, okay. Now, the interesting thing is, it was part of the Ottoman Empire, but it was only part of the Ottoman Empire for just slightly under 100 years. So, yes, because the Ottoman Empire ruled places like Egypt and the Middle East, that's why you saw lots of people with fezes. But they weren't around for centuries. It was actually kind of a 19th century attempt to modernize the turban, still, Muslims still covering the tops of their heads. But what's interesting is, of course, that's a hat without a brim. And you might be thinking, well, hang on, in the Middle East, surely you want something to cover your, to shade you from the sun. Well, that's what the main body of the hat is. And this is the interesting bit. The reason why it has no brim is if you have to think about how Muslims pray. They put their head, their forehead on the ground. You can't do that with a trilby or tricorn hat. So actually the fez allows you to do your prayers as you're meant to do, but also protect your head and still have a hat on. So it's actually a supremely practical thing. But interestingly, because it was a symbol of the old Ottoman Empire, when the new Republic of Turkey was created under a guy called Ataturk, or at least that was his nickname, he actually banned them. He banned them, and if you were caught wearing a fez, a sign of the old power and not the new republic, you would be sentenced to death. Now, I can't find any recorded occurrences of anybody being executed for wearing a fez, because let's face it, dying, no matter how much you like that piece of fashion, it's just not worth dying over, and so they didn't. Although, technically, to this day, in Iran, because a tie is seen as a sign of Western power, Western influence, it is illegal to wear a tie in Iran. And again, if you're caught wearing a tie, obviously if you're Iranian, if you happen to step off a plane and you're British and you don't know this, this isn't going to happen to you. But if in Iran, you're in a public place wearing a tie, you could also, in theory, be sentenced to death as well. So there we go. Is fashion worth dying over? I think the answer to that is no, not really. But we've covered shoes, ties, hats, wigs, shirts. We've dresses. We've done pretty well.
We've done pretty well for clothing history. And just to end it on a slightly lighter point than the death sentence. The image that immediately occurred to me when you said about the ties and the businessmen getting off the plane is, I can just imagine, I mean, you may have seen some of those border control programs on the television where they're doing all the, you know, the guy going in there trying to smuggle in the contraband ties into the country and just going through, no, you can keep the drugs, we're not worried about those.
Because it's one of those things. Huge pile of ties, yeah. That's a problem.
Because it's like the Australia one, they seem to be far, far more concerned every episode with a little bit of mud on somebody's shoe than they are with, or food or stuff than they ever are with drugs, because that is a specific problem, you know, everyone knows drugs about. I can just really imagine them going into the country, right, we're going to need to search this case. I think you've got a tie hidden inside this packet of heroin, you know.
Anyway, well, that's fairly dark too. So let's move on. I guess, is it fair to say you've done your plug?
I've done my plug, yes.
Okay, I will quickly do my plug. Do you know what? I'm going to change the tune for a change because I mentioned it earlier. So that fact about the shoes, the Romans and their shoes, I think that's fact 44 from my book, The Romans in 100 Facts. That's available via Amazon, bookshops, etc. It's published via Amberley. You can go onto Amberley's website and buy a copy there as well. So you basically got a quick rush through the whole of Roman history from foundation to when did it actually end, all in 100 facts. And a little under 200 pages.
And if anybody is wondering at all, because we just mentioned it earlier, I will also mention again the title of the other book we mentioned there was Forgotten Histories, which is the one where Jem talks about the history of the necktie. But that is...
And actually, just to jump in there for a second. Actually, November, that's what was my first hardback, but in November, it's coming out in paperback.
Forgotten Histories out in paperback in November. So that is all from us this week. Thank you very, very much to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducci.
And to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And please don't forget to like, subscribe, everything else. But for now, goodbye and take care.